Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Some of the New York voices of 2011, as produced by the WNYC Newsroom.
This convening itself is a metaphor for change. This convening itself says that change is possible in Albany. Believe it or not, and I say amen, because we need change in Albany.
From the Nile to the sea, Egypt is free.
From the Nile to the sea, Egypt is free.
The Egyptian young generation who achieved a remarkable achievement.
She and I met this morning, and we have mutually agreed that it is in the city's best interest if she steps down as chancellor. I will say I take full responsibility for the fact that this has not worked out as either of us had hoped and expected.
I didn't send that picture out.
But that's not a picture of you.
You know, I can't say with certitude.
Today I'm announcing my resignation from Congress.
Some of the New York voices of 2011, as produced by the WNYC Newsroom. That's an excerpt from the full 7-minute montage of End of Year Voices, which is an amazing compilation and production. And you can hear the whole thing on our website. Go to WNYC.org. And let's keep talking about the news of the day and the news of the year. With me now are Errol Lewis, host of Inside City Hall on New York One, and Karen Frillman, managing editor of WNYC News. Happy New Year, you two.
Thank
you. Good morning.
Errol, looking back, what story or topic do you think you have spent more time on than any other on your show Inside City Hall this year?
You know, it's fascinating. I think in terms of pure hours, you end up having to give the nod maybe to Anthony Weiner, just because we took so many of his press conferences and spent so much time talking about it. But I would say running a very close second would be everything related to schools, not just the Kathy Black hiring and later resignation, but also the kind of quiet semi-scandal or the very important news of the sort of reevaluation of New York City's test scores, which in a lot of ways is kind of a referendum on the schools over the last 8 to 10 years.
I'm glad you said that about education being at the top, because I think one of the biggest stories of the year, now really of the last 10 years, is that as we near the end of the Bloomberg era, education reform was supposed to be his legacy. And controversial as his policies have been, he has really tried to be a change agent. But how much he's actually been able to change anything is still kind of up for debate. And we'll come back to that later on. But Karen Frillman, managing editor of WNYC News, same question for you here in our WNYC local newsroom. Number one story in terms of radio minutes aired, what do you think?
Well, I think that as Occupy Wall Street warmed up, we covered that from pretty much the second day. And I know it was a debate every morning in our morning meeting, how much time to spend, what was this moving into. But we, especially in newscast, I think, we certainly covered that regularly for the 3 months that it really was hot, and continue to talk about it. And I also think we, you know, just to be a little bit, you know, not going to the heart of the Dominique Strauss-Kahn event, which also figured in our newscast because it was such a regular story as well. It unfolded. People were fascinated by it. But we also covered the census numbers as results began to pour in and details began to pour in. And as we looked at the phenomenon of black migration and African-American migration, people leaving the city. And as we looked at the poverty numbers. And so those were some of the things, as well as education, because we started our affiliation with School Book, with the New York Times, and Beth Fertig, who has been covering the schools for more than a decade. We also spent a lot of time looking at the reforms, as you said, and some of the data that's been coming out.
So, Errol, what do you think? How much has actually changed in the Bloomberg era in terms of outcomes for students? We know that the numbers of schools have gone up. They've opened so many new schools. There have been battles over closing schools labeled as failing schools. How much has actually changed?
It's hard to say. And, you know, there'll be a long time before we can really sort through a lot of it. I mean, probably the easiest sort of cut and drive critique, interestingly enough, has sort of come from the right. Some of the conservative critics of Bloomberg on education have said that, look, he, from the time he came in, he's boosted the amount of money paid to teachers by something like 60%. And they asked the question, which is a reasonable one, does anybody think we're getting 60% better results? And the answer kind of answers itself. You know, the reality is, it's like, well, whatever happened, even if you think things are better than they were before, I don't think anybody believes that they're 60% better. So that's kind of one, you know, easy and somewhat unfair cut at the question. The other look at it, though, which are these test scores, which is, you know, it's a real important sort of a thing, because again, this administration, nobody forced these metrics on them. They said they wanted to be judged by the state and federal test scores. They said that if they didn't get those numbers up, then they should be pronounced a failure. And when we look at it, and the, you know, sort of the great reset in 2011, when the state said, look, these tests are too easy, let's be more realistic about what actually constitutes proficiency, and you're down around, you know, 47% to 53% for students overall. And, you know, depending on the subgroup you're looking at, the numbers are absolutely dismal. You know, could it have been better, or would it be worse in, you know, Buffalo or Cleveland? That's the thing the administration often says, like, well, we're doing better than a lot of other big city schools, so you have to judge us by our peer group. That's a question that will take some time to sort of sort through. I do tend to think, though, that people voting with their feet is also kind of an indirect measure that people should look at. And when you see the insanity going on of kids trying to, parents trying to get their kids into charter schools, into private schools, into alternative learning situations, it doesn't reflect well on your standard zone public school.
And I don't want to turn this end of your segment, which is going to touch on a lot of things, into a very deep analysis of education, but it is one of the biggest stories, Karen, as far as I'm concerned, of the last 10 years in New York. And it can be kind of depressing if we think that here came a mayor with a lot of new power given him by the state legislature, mayoral control, and a lot of change that he pushed that was controversial, especially with Joel Klein as first chancellor. And if they were only able to, and I think they would argue that they made some more significant change than it may be sounding like right now, you know, that if you look at the national so-called NAEP numbers, that if they do have 15% more students reading at grade level or doing math at grade level than there was, a decade ago, 45% instead of 30%, that actually makes a really big difference for this relatively short period of time. But it also makes me think, well, is the top this low in terms of what the bureaucracy can actually accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's not looking that good for the overall idea of this as Bloomberg's legacy. One of the other things that we're looking at, they're talking about school closings. They're going to decide on them in January. And a number of the schools that will be closed are new schools that were opened under the Bloomberg administration. And that, I think, says something as well, because it's been such a contentious thing to go in and remake some of these neighborhood schools. And yet the really tough job of bringing up the bottom and bringing it up those kids who may not have had the early childhood education, maybe, you know, English, you know, new to the English language or special ed, we don't seem to be, there hasn't been much of a bump. And especially special ed, that's another story that we've been tracking. Those numbers, New York City is not performing that well when it comes to helping those students. And there's been a lot of money put at it. A third of our budget goes to special ed.
Let's change topics and, in fact, go back to Occupy Wall Street. And, Karen, you were talking about how here in the WNYC newsroom, there was a lot of discussion day by day. How much should we cover this? It's yet another day of an ongoing protest. How newsworthy is that? What do you think, taking as broad a look at it as you can, as a local story, that Occupy Wall Street has really meant? What has it meant to New York as a local phenomenon, other than whatever may have gone down in terms of rhetoric, in terms of conflict with the police, whatever, at Zuccotti Park and on the streets?
Well, I think it invigorated activists who in the New York region who had been kind of low under the Obama administration. There was such a groundswell and such a sense of optimism, as we know, when President Obama was elected. And I think the criticism, especially by activists, was pretty tough, especially after the bank bailouts and the real feeling of the abandonment of some hardcore progressive issues. And so I think that in talking with people and in watching the coverage of that story, I think it did activate activists and give them a sense of let's bring it up from the ground level. The top down doesn't work.
Errol, what would you add to that in terms of the local impact of the Occupy movement, which obviously had national, if not global, impact? What about the New York impact?
I think it shook up a lot of people who had been trying to get the same point across. I mean, really the very same point across. I had heard from and had lunch with any number of labor leaders over a number of years, really, the last couple of years, saying, we've got to do something about this inequality. We've got to talk about it. We've got to march. You've got to let us talk about it on your show. And, you know, we tried to air it out as well as we could, you know, in a reasonable kind of way that was consistent with actual news. But Occupy Wall Street really just rewrote that entire script. And they, you know, to a great extent, they occupied the public conversation, which, of course, is what they intended to do. They even, I think, got a lot of journalists thinking about what is and isn't news and why should you or should you not cover a story. And they certainly gave everybody a common vocabulary. So you hear in all kinds of different settings people talking about, I'm with the 99% or I'm with the 1% or you're doing too much for the 1%. And we all kind of know what that means. And in a city where, as much as we're a commercial center, you almost never hear people talk about relative levels of wealth or of income in anything approaching a direct, quantifiable way. You know, we talk about all the rich people on Park Avenue, all the poor people in the inner city. But this got a little bit more precise. It sort of sharpened the knife a little bit, and it sharpened the discussion. And I think that, in many ways, is not only what they intended, but is the biggest success of the Occupy movement.
We'll continue in a minute with Karen Froman, managing editor of WNYC News, and Errol Lewis, host of Inside City Hall on New York One, talking about some of the most important news, politics, and issue developments in the New York area in 2011. We will get to the poverty numbers that came out this year that WNYC did a lot of reporting on, as Karen mentioned. We will get to the rise of Andrew Cuomo's power and Chris Christie's power and maybe the beginning of the fall of Michael Bloomberg's power. We will get to the weather, which this year, in my opinion, was not a trivial story. And the first thing we'll do after the break is we'll listen to another one-minute excerpt of the news of the year montage produced by WNYC News. So stay with us. Some more of the New York Voices of 2011 as produced by the WNYC Newsroom.
They have, you know, the names around and they have like the water. So it's supposed to be like, I guess, soothing for people that are coming to remember their loved ones.
It's a place to come and honor and remember their loved ones. But it's also a place to be filled with hope.
I don't know what you can do, even in retrospect, about record rainfall and record floods.
I want a violin, rising night and day.
We had 30 years of things that are ruined, my mom's things that are ruined. I mean, but that's the stuff, but we're lucky.
The lamp was shaking, so then I was just really scared, so I got my dad, and it was just really weird because I've never felt that before.
Some of the Voices of 2011 is produced by the WNYC News team. You can hear the full 7-minute montage at our website, WNYC.org. WNYC News Managing Editor Karen Frillman is here along with Errol Lewis, host of Inside City Hall on New York One, as we talk about the news of the day and the news of the year. And listeners, what development of 2011 do you want to draw more attention to as the year wanes here? From the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, anything at all, or post it to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And, Errol, we have to talk about the weather this year, which was not trivial, figured very prominently in that excerpt from the montage. We began the year in the grip of the December 26, 2010 blizzard. Then we had Hurricane Irene, an earthquake, if you count that as weather, and the freak October snowstorm. So three big power outage events and questions about global warming.
Well, I'd say the first two were extremely important, very much more important than the others. I mean, the earthquake sort of semi-event was not all that disruptive. A hurricane was unbelievable. I mean, I think it's the first time in my lifetime that they actually shut down the transit system.
Right.
That was extraordinary. Yes.
And got praised for doing so.
Yes, and I mean, in retrospect, it was the right thing to do. I mean, the cost, of course, was very, very high. But, of course, that, you know, you really have to link with the winter storm, which was handled abysmally and I think pointed out some major, major shortcomings in the emergency management system of the city. And the Bloomberg administration took a lot of hits, some of them very well deserved, for not informing the public of where the mayor was or who was in charge. You know, it turned out when I was interviewing deputy mayors, they themselves did not know where some of their key colleagues were. And I think the administration got the message that it was completely unacceptable, as did the rest of the city. So it was really important, and it'll be important far beyond 2011.
And even the October snowstorm, that became the biggest story in Connecticut, where, again, after lengthy power outages in much of the state, as there had been during Irene, Connecticut Light and Power came under a lot of criticism, and they've been forced to make some changes. And in terms of what we can do about these things, Karen, and whether we can expect more of them, it does raise the global warming question. It's not completely answerable as to whether these events this year had to do with global warming, but it's certainly a question. Certainly a question as pertains to what we can expect more of. We heard the clip in the montage of Governor Cuomo kind of throwing up his hands more than maybe he should have. I don't know what you can do about rising rainfall, et cetera, when at the same time, engineers and city planners are very actively asking themselves, what can we do? What do we have to do along the coastline of Lower Manhattan and elsewhere?
Yeah, and especially in the subways, where we know they shut down the subway and came within a foot of the subway's flooding. And we did not get hit by Irene as we thought we might. The storm surge did not come. Salt water did not pour into the tracks. But based on our reporting and Transportation Nation's Andrea Bernstein's did a piece on this, and basically the MTA would not have been ready to pump out that water. They do not have the capability to do that. They're working on it. They've got great engineers, but it's this nexus of infrastructure upgrades, and the coffers are empty. I mean, the MTA is running at a deficit now, and so I think it's going to take all of our ingenuity and really a kind of going through the numbers to figure out how we are going to update our infrastructure, because we don't get the sense that the money is there to do it.
Yehudit in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling. Wait a minute. Sorry, Yehudit. My problem. I think we have you now. Hi.
Okay. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
My issue personally and politically is gay marriage.
A big, big story that I mentioned at the very top of the show. Gay marriage, legal gay marriage, came to New York State. Absolutely historic.
My wife and I were the first gay couple to be legally married at our synagogue in Parkville Jewish Center.
Yeah, congratulations.
Congratulations,
indeed. And I've been politically involved in that issue for 30 years.
So,
and it is a story that in thinking about a bunch of these stories, there it's a story this year. But you're right, the movement and the change and the work and the efforts around that have been going on for years. So that this year it could be capped off by a successful vote in the state Senate. New York was late to this issue. I mean, it was legal in Iowa before it was legal in New York, but it was many, many years of work by a lot of people. You're right.
Thank you very much. And, you know, it gets to the issue, too, of politics, Errol, and the power of Governor Cuomo. We have two real mockers in office, you know, to draw from the old country language in Albany and Trenton right now, Cuomo and Christie, very powerful governors compared to recent years. Think about the Patterson-Corzine era or the Spitzer McGreevy era. This is really pretty different. And the success of gay marriage in getting through the New York State Legislature is one of the results of that. Would you agree?
And if so,
what makes Andrew Cuomo such a powerful governor compared to, say, Patterson, who mostly had the same agenda?
You know, it's interesting, the comparison with Christie, because, as you know, Christie or any governor of New Jersey has a ton of power. I mean, by far the most powerful of the 50 governors of the state, and that's just because of the way New Jersey is set up. Cuomo's power derives from his experience in government. You know, he had the same kind of popularity that Spitzer had coming into office, but he had a very different approach, and he had fought it all through. And this owes to, I think you can attribute this to the time that he spent in government with his father. And so he knows a lot of these guys. He knows how they operate. He knows where their weak points are. He brought them over to the mansion time after time after time, and he wined and dined them. He didn't insult them. He didn't threaten to campaign against them, at least not in public. He didn't threaten them. There was quite a lot of arm twisting behind the scenes. And he got them to do what he wanted. And so I think this is, you know, it's been an extraordinary, he had an extraordinary first session, an extraordinary first year. Whether he can duplicate it or not, nobody knows. But that power came from a very skillful use of a lot of the reform pressure that was being put on the legislature, a lot of the editorial boards that had been beating up on them for years, a lot of the prosecutions and convictions and corruption problems that were going on. Cuomo took his hand, and he just played it masterfully.
But it does raise the question. I agree, Errol. He had a great first year. And now one of the stories that's, of course, bubbling up is hydrofracking. And that's going to be, I think, a very tough moment for Andrew Cuomo, because it's so divisive and the sides are so split, and there's no there's really no nuancing it. And it'll be very interesting. He's going to have to make a decision, it looks like, next year.
By the way,
it's interesting, Karen. I think of this as, I mean, hydrofracking is getting to be almost what I would call a sort of a religious issue, sort of like charter schools and a couple of other issues where, you know, people make up their minds and then the other side is completely demonized and there's not a lot of common ground. But wouldn't you say that gay marriage sort of enjoyed the same kind of status?
Yeah, but the implications of environmental, of the potential environmental problems, I think that gay marriage over time, people have seen that it's, if anything, brought families together. It's something that, you know, very conservative people find that they have a gay child or a gay nephew and niece, and so it's in fact allowed people to enjoy greater family comfort. I think about hydrofracking, and I think one of the issues is there's a lack of trust there. We're still trying to bring the waterfront back from the issues that industry brought to them within the, you know, most of the 20th century. So it's hard to say, yes, we trust, you know, I mean, I think this is where the debate goes, to say, yeah, we're sure that those gas drilling companies are going to make good if there are problems with the water supply.
I don't know why there isn't more focus from the, you know, the traditional marriage community, let's say, on the social impact of family breakdown. I know, obviously, they talk about it, but there was such fervor to stop marriage equality when marriage equality, for the most part, does just bring more people together. When family breakdown really is an issue in our society, you know, and yet people could find more animation to talk about, you know, preventing marriages than saving marriages. But maybe I digress. Let's see. How about George in Manhattan? You're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it. Thank you.
Listen, this whole issue of education, I'm a school psychologist. I've been involved with kids for a long, long time. When I first came to New York, all they wanted to do was push Black and Puerto Rican kids into special ed, and especially kids that were bilingual. They didn't want to give kids that had, who spoke Italian, for instance, and couldn't speak English because they just got here. They didn't want to put them in regular classrooms. Now what they're trying to do is they're trying to force kids to learn how to take tests and do well on the tests. So your test performance of 45 or 47 or whatever it is represents the inability of the school system to adjust to the tests that are now being used. As soon as the teachers learn the tests, then you'll see that the test scores will go higher because all they'll be doing is spending their entire time teaching kids to take tests. But what they're not doing is teaching kids how to live a life or how to apply what they're learning in the classroom to their everyday life outside the classroom. So, you know, the kids come in, they hear something that has no semblance whatsoever to their lives as they know it, or they're not able to get any help from their parents because their parents certainly haven't heard any of this themselves coming from somewhere else. We have a very multinational population in the city. And
but George, let me jump in. This is you know, the many sides, the many sides of
live.
Of course, it's a multifaceted question. But what's really the school's job? Is it the school's job to teach the kids how to live? Because on the one hand, you get people like yourself saying that and people saying, well, we shouldn't be teaching kids just what's on a test. We should be teaching them to learn or to learn how to learn. But then we turn around and say, wait a minute, our fourth graders can't write a sentence, or our eighth graders can't do basic algebra at astronomical proportions. And that's where, dare I speak a sympathetic word about the standardized testing movement, the standardized testing movement comes from, that at least they should try to make sure that the bottom is that all children can do basic math, basic reading, basic writing, and they'll be much more prepared to live a life in the world as a result than if they weren't prepared with those things.
I agree with that 100%. But unfortunately, what happens is that the school mentality is not to teach them how to read and write. Its school mentality is how to prepare them for either the test or for the next grade or for college. And they have these ideas in their head. This is what the kid needs to learn, not how to read and write, not how to do arithmetic that applies directly to living their lives, but somehow esoteric arithmetic that will somehow get them into college or help them do well later in life.
George, thank you. But, Karen, that's where, again, they go round and round at the next level of analysis, which is the standardized test actually reflecting the ability to read and write and do math, or is it reflecting something else? People say teach to the test as if the test wasn't actually measuring the ability to read when it's a reading test or the ability to do math when it's a math test.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, I think this is a debate that I know a lot of teachers have, but I know Beth Fertig, who reports on education for us, brought back a story from a school in, I think it was in the Bronx, and these kids were basically having a very full education experience. There were all kinds of, you know, different modules set up in the classroom, and it was a very interactive, very creative classroom. And the test scores came, and the kids were not able to do the basics. And I think this is really the challenge, and this is the dilemma. And I don't think that we've solved it yet.
We're talking about the big New York area stories of the year with Karen Frillman, managing editor of WNYC News, and Era Lewis, host of Inside City Hall on New York One, and with you. Continue to post your most meaningful developments in our region to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Karen, you mentioned earlier the poverty numbers that came out for New York City as well as for the country. A major, major development, though it's overlooked in most news coverage, I think, which is almost always focused on the middle class as much as newsrooms can do. What was important in the poverty numbers?
Well, I think, you know, we have a reporter who covers poverty, Cindy Rodriguez, and so we have, it's not a story that we cover every 10 years. I think the fact that the numbers bumped up in New York was discouraging. This was another Bloomberg initiative to try to actually bring poverty numbers down and, you know, paying kids to go to school if they get good grades, basically trying some innovative programs that have worked in other places. But what we've seen, the Census Bureau, the numbers showed that the disparity between the rich and the poor, New York State has the greatest gap of any state in the country, and our city's numbers have bumped up so that we're technically it's 1 in 5, but it's actually a lot closer to 1 in 4.
Errol, is this purely a failure on the mayor's part, or, you know, as an excuse or explanation, one can say, well, he bumped up against the Great Recession, which happened to occur during his term?
Yeah, that is the excuse that they tend to use. On the other hand, you know, before the Great Recession, the numbers were rising. So we knew in the course of the debate that went along with the 2009 mayoral election or re-election that homelessness was rising to record levels. And that's a sort of a proxy for a particular kind of poverty. And, the voters knew going into the booth that it had reached record level. Or I hope they did if they listened to your show or watched mine. And, the administration has tried a number of different things, and the spin is always going to be there. You know, if they have a success, it's owing to their wisdom and ingenuity. If they have a problem, it's somebody else's fault, or it's not as bad as it could have been. And so, you know, this is what politicians do, this is what administrations do, and we expect that. I think, though, the underreported nature of it reflects a certain kind of exhaustion to a certain extent with the populace as a whole. I mean, these are not new numbers. They may have reached a kind of crescendo in the last couple of years or this year, but this is an ongoing problem, the grinding poverty that just goes on generation after generation. The numbers are probably higher than most people realize because to say 20% of the city is poor, you know, if you visualize it, think about the next crowded train that you're on and think about every fifth person being in a financial emergency. It gives you a sense of how serious this is. There was at least one ad, I think the Coalition for the Homeless did this, where they had a sort of a montage that purported to be like kids linking hands, because if you linked all of the homeless kids in New York City hand to hand, it would stretch from the tip of Manhattan all the way down to the Battery. So it's serious. It's there. The administration has tried some initiatives. You know, my sense is that they're completely out of scale. And I mean, I've asked them this in every interview that, you know, they just came up with this new initiative to try and help the Young Men's Initiative. If you break down the amount of numbers, the amount of people that they're trying to help, they're trying to target 315,000 hard-to-serve kids who are neither employed nor in school and who are in their late teens, early 20s. The amount of money that they're going to spend comes to something like $138 per kid per year for 3 years. I don't think that's even remotely in the range of what could turn around a major problem like this, but that's what the administration is offering right now.
We just have a minute left. I want to touch one other thing from New York City this year. And Errol, you've been covering the many neighborhoods of New York, especially Brooklyn, from your days as a community activist there through your days as a daily news columnist, and now with New York One, has the relationship between the NYPD and the people of the neighborhoods that they most aggressively police been changing? Our wonderful reporter, Elsa Chang, just won a DuPont Award for reporting on the Stop and Frisk program's marijuana bust numbers. And it seemed like her story may have actually had an impact in changing policy to to not arrest kids who are found with marijuana in their pockets that are not being that's not being displayed if the cops find it during a stop and frisk. But how reflective of that is that of, you know, declining relationships between the NYPD and communities around New York? Improving relationships was a hallmark of the Bloomberg administration and Ray Kelly after the contentious Giuliani years. Is it falling apart?
I think things were very, very bad. And I did hear some of Elsa's reports the day that they came out. And it was extraordinary. It was great. I think you're being very modest. There's no question that it changed policy. And it revealed a practice that was borderline illegal, but certainly questionable by the police, having people display the marijuana and then arrest them for displaying it. I mean, that's, you know, I think everybody at that point understood that that's not the right way to do it. I think the relationship is changing. And one side of it, I worry less about the police side of it because, you know, it is what it is. I think the community side has developed a level of sophistication that has not been adequately reported on. For about 10 years now, there's been this growing movement where people are trying new and interesting strategies. There's the ceasefire model. It's being tried in Crown Heights now. There's a sort of a community probation model. They just opened an office. This is Community Plus, the administration in Brownsville. There's some interesting things that are being tried, and this stuff has been vetted and tested and tried out nationally. New York's finally getting around to it. I think that may start to yield some actual results. I don't know if relationships are so bad that, you know, we're at risk of having a new riot or something like that. I do know that there's a generation after generation of kids, and a new cohort of kids is about every 4 or 5 years, who are extremely alienated and extremely depressed. Some of that is because of the poverty. Some of that is because of the problems they're having in school. Some of it is because of the friction with the police. But I don't feel like we're at a boiling point right now.
Karen,
and of course, obviously, I could be wrong.
20 seconds on the same question.
You know, I think that we are hearing that, you know, as Errol says, a new group of young men especially are basically fearing the police. They can't trust. They don't feel like that's a relationship. They feel targeted. And I think the stop and frisk numbers look to be at record highs again this year.
WNYC News Managing Editor Karen Frillman. Karen, thank you so much for all your work. You know, when we do fundraisers and stuff, I always say that the number one reason to support WNYC is not this show. It's our local news department for all that you and your people get out there and cover the whole metro region. So, Karen, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Errol Lewis, host of Inside City Hall on New York One, thank you for your always insightful analysis.
Big year coming up. Thanks very much, and Happy New Year to you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, some dessert. Dana Stevens from Slate will review and take your reviews of some of the big new end-of-year movies coming out. Stay with us.